Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome everybody to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast. Today we are going to discuss ischemic heart disease, and we have our resident medical expert in with us today, our guest, Dinesh.
First of many,
hopefully. Dinesh, how are you?
Hey guys, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming in. So Dinesh is going to help us with all the clinical stuff. We'll be discussing what ischemic heart disease is, and how it presents, and then what we could potentially do clinically to treat ischemic heart disease. Matt, where do we want to start? Do you want to define what ischemic heart disease is?
All right, so ischemia in itself, I guess, would be defined as a reduction in blood flow into a tissue or location. Now, this is different to, say, hypoxemia, which could be more systemically based, whereas ischemia is a reduction in an area. Now, I guess, speaking in reference to the heart, this is a reduction in blood flow to just the heart, probably most specifically the heart muscle itself, because that is the area that's probably working the hardest, and that's the area that's going to run out of oxygen first.
So when you reduce blood flow, you're obviously reducing oxygen delivery, but also nutrient delivery as well.
Yeah.
And so there is another distinguishing factor there between hypoxia and ischemia, is that hypoxia is more so relating to the lack of oxygen, when the ischemia is lack of oxygen, but also the nutrients that go along with that blood flow.
Mm. And probably the draining away of the metabolic toxins and so forth. So they're probably going to start building up in the heart as well, because you're not getting that flow to take it away. In terms of stats, Dinesh, what are we looking at in terms of ischemic heart? How many people in Australia? Any stats there?
It's actually one of the leading causes of death around the world. So the consequences of having an ischemic heart eventually causes death in a lot of people. And that's one of the biggest problems that we face at the moment. In terms of people presenting to the emergency departments in the Gold Coast with heart attacks, it's about 70,000 a year.
Just in the Gold Coast?
No, in Australia.
Okay.
With confirmed cases of ACS, and that's a number that the...
And ACS is acute coronary syndrome.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one of the numbers that's been thrown around. It's around 70,000.
Wow, okay. And how many of those... So I know that the mortality rate is variable, but within, I think within the first year or first 5 years, would you say the mortality rate post-MI is quite high?
Yeah, it can be, and that depends on a lot of things. So it depends on a person's age, for example, what existing diseases they have, mm-hmm. what existing cardiovascular diseases they have, time to treatment, and the way it's managed. So that's dependent on a lot of things.
Okay.
But, I mean, if you're someone who has a history of heart attacks, who's had stents, who might be of advanced age with a lot of other problems going on, the prognosis can be quite grim.
Worse and worse. All right. Yeah. So a couple of take-home points. Well, so firstly, in the Western world, or the developed world, it's the number one killer of mortality. So that's ischemic heart. Sometimes they will use the term coronary artery disease as well, and that generally refers to a spectrum of, angina being stable, moving to unstable, and then you go into forms of myocardial infarction. Is that safe by saying that in terms of the terms?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
And in terms of ACS, which is an acronym you use, that's acute coronary syndrome, which generally means unstable angina, and then the STEMI or non-STEMI.
Exactly, okay. That's right.
All right. And this is finally just to touch up on the ischemia versus hypoxemia. Mm. Ischemia is generally caused by a blockage in the pipes in the heart. So the coronary vessels that supply the heart, they're going to get generally, in most cases, blocked by clogs of fatty fibrous tissue. Is that fair?
Yeah, these fibrofatty atherosclerotic plaques.
And in fact, when you get a heart attack or ACS, it's generally when that plaque ruptures and throws off a clot.
Okay.
So if we have, so if we look at these plaques that are building up, you can have stable and unstable plaques, and stable plaques will be sitting there within the intima of the blood vessel, and it will obviously occlude the blood vessel to a varying degree. If, as far as I'm aware, if it occludes the blood vessel to about, and it's stable, which means it hasn't, it's not thrombogenic, hasn't created a thrombus and thrown itself away. If it's there and it occludes the vessel around about 70%, then you will get some sort of ischemic event during exercise, because obviously you increase the need for oxygen around the body, increase the activity of the heart. Heart requires more oxygen as well. And then also the blood vessel has less of a capacity to be able to dilate, which is very important.
Right.
But if it's occluded around about 90%, then you can get ischemic events at rest. And so this occlusion just means a blockage. And we need to just remember the fact, and we've said it before, that you've got a blood vessel, it's a pipe, and you know it makes sense to think that if you were to block half of that pipe, you'd stop half the blood flow going through, but that's not the case. It's to the power of 4. So if you'd halve the area of that pipe, or occlude it by half, you're changing the amount of blood flow. 1/16th of the amount of blood will be getting through, as opposed to 1/2. And so,
quite a lot.
So you could occlude the vessel by not a great deal, but you drastically alter the amount of blood that can get through. An unstable plaque.
Can I stop you for 1 second?
Yeah, go for it.
Just before we go completely into ischemic, we did speak about hypoxemia. So this is, I guess what we're talking is, today we're looking at why there's a mismatch between oxygen supply, so oxygen getting to the heart, versus how much the heart actually needs. So it's that demand versus supply, right? Is that fair by saying, guys?
I would say so.
Okay, so it's kind of like that balance beam between how much oxygen has been delivered to the heart versus how hard the heart's working.
Yeah.
Now, we said that we have the ischemia, which is generally by the blockage in the pipes, but you also said that there is a hypoxemia, which we're not going to focus on, but we'll just point out what kind of conditions may lead to hypoxemia and still the end result having an infarction or a heart attack. Some of these conditions could be, well, anemia, severe anemia?
Yeah. If it's severe enough, yeah. And that kind of condition is called type 2 myocardial injury.
Okay.
So you can get it in people in extreme cases of anemia, and even when the body's under extreme amounts of stress, so if they are septic, sometimes if they have an exacerbation of COPD,
for example, so lung issues.
Lung issues, yep. And
what about like carbon monoxide poisoning? Would they get it for that? Would that be the reason why they may die, if they've just got no oxygen in their blood because it's got carbon monoxide on the hemoglobin?
It could be one of the consequences for it. But with carbon monoxide poisoning, you could also get brain injury.
Right, okay. Mm. So kind of a stroke.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that you can get a whole host of problems that occur.
Okay.
Another one is cocaine use.
Yeah.
So
what is it doing there?
With cocaine toxicity, it affects the coronary vessels. So it can cause vasospasm.
Like a constriction.
Which can then cause myocardial injury.
Yeah, right.
So with people coming in with...
So we live on the Gold Coast, and you're at Gold Coast University Hospital.
That's right.
Does that mean that this is something that you've seen quite often?
I mean, there is a population that obviously uses cocaine.
Yeah.
And when they come in with chest pain, it's definitely one of the things that you want to have on the top of your mind.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because it could be one of the more drastic consequences.
And do they need to overdose on it? I mean, not overdose on it, but do they need to take an exorbitant amount of it in order to get these sensations? Or is this just a... As far as you're aware, obviously as a non-cocaine user, hopefully, that, just recreational use can lead to this type of chest pain.
Well, this is one of the problems with any recreational drugs. It's not manufactured in a controlled way.
Yeah.
You don't really know the pharmacodynamics of what you're getting.
Right.
So you can't really... if you have a whole heap, it'll probably affect you a lot more.
Mm.
So overdose is a problem. But you can't really predict the pharmacodynamics and its effects on your physiology.
Sure.
So it could be as little or as lot could cause any of these complications.
Yeah. Okay. And one last one, just out of interest. What about shunting? Have you ever seen a heart that has a congenital defect and for some reason it allows the blood to go in the opposite direction? Have you ever seen that may cause a myocardial injury?
Yeah. In kids, that's a big problem.
Okay.
If it happens.
Yeah.
And that's going to... I mean, there are different types of anatomical
abnormalities
that can cause that, but they'll have systemic issues with that.
So it's not just that.
And there are certain types of congenital defects that are not even survivable.
Oh, sure. Well, wow. Yeah. Okay.
But the pediatric cardiothoracics guys do some amazing types of surgeries to correct a lot of these things.
Even in utero now, right? Which is phenomenal.
Have you seen or heard of paradoxical emboli, in which it originates in the venous system, and then when it gets into the right side of the heart, it can go through a patent foramen ovale, for example, and then shunt itself across to the left system and then cause a blockage there. I'm sure that's rare, but I know that it can happen.
Yeah, so one of the biggest risks with that is having a stroke. Because you throw that into the left and it could go up into your intracranial circulation and cause a stroke.
Because you'd imagine it'd be pretty tough to get a clot from the ventricle in the coronary system, right? Even though it's the first branch, but it has to almost fill in diastole.
Mm.
So you'd think the clot just gets thrown straight into the aorta and then up to the brain or
it's
elsewhere.
A risk.
Yeah.
I think this leads us to an important point that, and I'm sure you can verify this for us, Dinesh, that the majority of the time, the left side of the heart's going to be affected for ischemic heart disease. I mean, you can have...
it's a good point.
And so...
So the left side of the heart, left ventricle.
Left ventricle, right? And so, as far as I'm aware, for a number of reasons. One reason being that left ventricle is thicker. You know, it's about 1.5 centimetres compared to half a centimetre for the right ventricle. And so the thicker the muscle, the harder it contracts, the more oxygen itself requires, which means that if you've got an issue with lack of oxygen delivery, the left ventricle is going to be affected first. The other reason being that when the left ventricle contracts, so under systole, that contraction, it'll go from 0 millimeters of mercury to about 125 millimeters of mercury. And this contractile force actually strangulates the capillary system of that left ventricle and closes it up, which means that the capillary system of the left ventricle or the left myocardium only fill and deliver its nutrients during diastole, during relaxation. The right ventricle can deliver its oxygen and nutrients in both systole and diastole because the contractile force goes from 0 to about 25 and isn't sufficient enough to strangulate the capillaries of the system. So that left ventricle, as far as I'm aware, and again, please tell me that I'm correct. I just haven't been making things up for the past 5 minutes. Is mainly affected, and maybe the right side could be affected if you get right side hypertrophy, maybe a core pulmonale or something like that, leading to right hypertrophy.
Yeah, you can get ischemic events that affect both sides of the heart, and I'm not sure about the numbers of each, but I suppose the thing to remember there is that a significant left-sided insult will probably likely be quite catastrophic. From that perspective.
And that's because the left side of the heart, when it contracts, will deliver the oxygenated blood to the whole body. And so if there's failure there, there's failure for systemic oxygen delivery.
That's right.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right. So with that said, I think we can now go and focus specifically on the ischemic heart spectrum.
Clinical presentations?
Yeah, so we've got, just to reiterate, we've got the four main types. We've got stable angina, we've got unstable angina, we've got NSTEMI, which means a non-ST elevation myocardial infarction. When we say infarction, that actually means now complete cessation of blood to the area, rather than ischemia, which is just a reduction.
And the infarct is referring to death.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we have the STEMI, which is the ST elevation myocardial infarction. Now, so that's the kind of like the
spectrum.
The spectrum, right. Now, in terms of the size of the pipe, so this is what you were alluding to. Do you want to just flesh that out for a second? So out of the four types, what kind of things are happening in the coronary vessel?
In regards to...
just what it's doing to allow the blood through. So that stable one, you said, generally means there is a narrowing, mm-hmm. potentially up to a 70% amount.
Yeah.
But it's the plaque itself... the occlusion itself is fairly stable.
Yes.
And so that would produce a predictable kind of pain.
As far as I'm aware, yeah.
Because like you put more demand on the heart, mm-hmm. it needs more oxygen, like you exercise or you're emotionally stressed or physically stressed or whatever.
Yeah.
It needs more blood, but you're only getting 70%, or 70% is occluded.
Yeah.
So it now is bringing on a predictable pain.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say, Dinesh?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
And so then when you move to an unstable,
mm-hmm.
the plaque is now doing things that is behaving, you know...
So if you look at the plaque, the plaque's going to be predominantly this fatty deposit sitting within the intima. There's a couple of different inflammatory and chemical cascades that are going on. You've got foam cells, you've got macrophages, you've got this little cap that sits over the top of it, and a couple of things can happen in which you can have the fat that sits within this plaque rupture out. And again, this is a thrombogenic situation, which means it promotes a thrombus formation. So platelets coming in, and we know that platelets, when one platelet comes in, it stimulates more platelets to come in and stimulates the stickiness of platelets, and this forms a thrombus. It can also just increase platelet aggregation on the cap itself. And again, thrombus formation. And this thrombus can come off, lift off, and then when you look at arteries go from bigger arteries to smaller arterioles to even smaller capillaries. And then at some point, it will occlude a vessel. And this occlusion can be a full occlusion and fully limit the amount of oxygen that's getting passed and nutrients getting passed to feed the tissue. Distal from that occlusion. And so then you're getting, so that's the unstable plaque as a present, or a dynamic plaque, or acute changes to a plaque.
And so how would the pain, so Dinesh, how would the pain be different between an unstable and stable angina? So if you're seeing a patient, what's a classical unstable?
Yeah, exactly. So with the stable angina, it's going to be activity dependent.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, you'll get someone who experiences pain when they're anywhere from walking to running, from mild activities to strenuous activity. But unstable angina is when you actually get pain at rest.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a more concerning picture.
So if we look at... now, obviously, we can only talk generalities and we can only talk statistics because everyone's different. Patient history.
Mm.
Would you say that the majority of individuals... that come in have a history of smoking, for example, have a family history of heart disease?
So the classic risk factors for ischemic heart disease, or ACS, smoking is huge.
Okay.
And smoking is a risk factor for any...
everything. Everything ever.
Everything. So from obviously things like lung cancer to whatever else, but it has significant changes on your vascular system.
Yeah.
And obviously your heart or ischemic heart disease is something that is a result of vascular disease. So smoking is a huge risk factor. And, you know, even a couple of years of smoking can cause changes.
Yeah.
And I've read some studies that suggest that, you know, it causes instantaneous, you know, acute changes in your vasculature.
Wow.
But smoking is a huge risk factor.
Yeah.
There are a few other things as well. Family history is a component risk factor, particularly if one of your first degree relatives have had a cardiac event young.
Yeah.
Okay.
And how do you classify young? Is there an age where you can't...
Under 50, under 55?
Look, I can't remember the number specifically, but, you know, if in their 40s or even early 50s they've had a cardiac event, you'd probably be more cautious.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'd assume that, because it's so prevalent, you're going to get, what, one in three people over the age of 60 have some sort of cardiac event, right, or some sort of cardiovascular disease of some sort. It's pretty common.
Yeah.
So you got smoking, history of heart disease. What about BMI?
Blood pressure?
Yes. So, hypertension is another one. High cholesterol is another one.
And so cholesterol-wise, what are you guys looking at? Is there particularly one that that seems more sinister?
Yeah, so HDL, so different types of cholesterol. HDL is known to be protective.
Mm.
So high levels of HDL... are a protective factor, but LDL is thought to be a culprit.
Mm.
Triglycerides and VLDL as well.
Okay.
So high levels of those types of cholesterol are a risk factor for atherosclerotic disease.
So in the emergency, and we'll talk about this in a sec, but just to talk about it quickly now.
Yeah.
Individual comes in and you take bloods and you have a look at various things. Do you look at... obviously, apart from the markers to see whether there's an MI or whatever, do you look at cholesterol levels? Do you look at LDLs or anything? Or are you just looking at what's happening right now?
Exactly. Exactly. So, in the emergency department, we don't run tests like lipid profiles. We look at acute problems, and in the long term, either the GP, the cardiologist, or their long-term care providers will run those tests.
Okay.
But often, when we get a person in, they'll know that they have a history of high cholesterol. They might be on a statin to lower their cholesterol levels. So there might be an established history already.
Yeah.
Okay. Just with that, I just read an interesting study, and they looked at HDL, but what they did with it, this was in a mouse study, and they actually induced a myocardial infarction in the mouse. So they somehow put a constriction, constricting a device around the coronaries. They could induce an MI, but then they quickly injected HDL into the rat's blood system, and then they took the constriction off. And they found that the rats that were given that bolus of HDL, they not only... their cardiac output was 10% better straight after the MI, but also they recovered much better post-MI, so their heart didn't scar as much. And the thought behind it is HDL actually binds to some of the myocyte cells and enhance the way that glucose is uptaken into the cell to make ATP without oxygen.
So more energy efficient.
Yeah, more energy efficient. Huh. And so that's thought to be something there as well.
So that sort of feeds into what, like you said, cardioprotective. So not just impartial and negligible or you know, has no effect. It actually may be cardioprotective from that stance. So does that mean that LDLs, in that sense, actively... So as far as I'm aware... HDLs deposit the cholesterol.
Other way.
Oh, sorry. HDLs take the cholesterol, send it to the liver for processing. LDLs deposit the cholesterol. And that may be an oversimplistic picture, but is that as far as you're aware?
Yeah, and there are a few validated tools that you use for the risk of cardiovascular disease. So different things like the Framingham score, which you guys might be aware of. But it's a study that came out of the UK, and it was this huge study over a long period of time that included a lot of people. Mm. And I think it was really one of the first studies that established the risk factors for heart disease. And in clinical practice, it's really useful to use some of these objective tools or calculators to calculate risk for people.
Mm.
And what one of the things that a lot of these measurements use are LDL and HDL levels, okay, specifically.
Yeah. One other quick question, because Mike and I were given this question on the radio the other night, and it's in terms of females and when they're having a potential heart attack, how do they present just like males, or is there variability?
Yeah.
And so that's the first question too. The second one is, if a female was to come into you with chest pain and she was under, say, 40, would you be not thinking heart attack because it's just that unlikeliness that she will have?
Yeah. Okay, so this is an interesting topic. So when you look at the clinical presentation for a heart attack, right, classically, you look at a type of chest pain,
mm-hmm,
and it's more actually discomfort. Mm. So people say they feel a squeezing sensation, a pressure-like sensation, an elephant might be sitting on their chest.
Yeah. So not pain per se, but exactly, discomfort.
Yeah. They might feel a fullness in their chest, and it could be mild to severe. They'll also potentially have radiation to the shoulders, so that pain might be felt in the shoulders, one or both of the arms, fingers, and your lower jaw.
Wow, okay.
Not the upper jaw, and usually not below the belly button. Wow. So sometimes it also radiates to the back as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what you look for in a classic scenario.
Yeah.
So there are some special groups like women, people with diabetes, and the elderly that might present differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that really complicates things a bit more.
Yeah.
So sometimes people just present with shortness of breath, or they might faint, or they might feel palpitations, they might feel nauseous.
Sweaty.
So
vomiting
sometimes, yep.
And that's like an inferior infarct, right?
It's, you can't really localize,
okay,
an infarct based on symptoms alone.
Okay, because I always thought that from the base of the heart or behind the heart, because the vagus nerve is going through that kind of area, by infarcting that, sometimes it irritates the vagus, which brings on GIT symptoms and even maybe cause other, you know, bradycardia with it.
Yeah, potentially. But a lot of the arrhythmias that happen are from myocardial injury,
okay,
and thus a disruption of conducting system. But also they might get epigastric discomfort, so that's just the upper part of your stomach.
Mm.
So, yes, women can present differently with it, and they're a special group that are generally documented to be cautious about as well. And if you talk about women under 40, as you were saying. So it certainly could be one of the differentials. And there are, you know, guys and girls in their 30s that come in as well. But they have a whole heap of risk factors generally. Mm. But you could think about heart attack, but there are also a bunch of different other conditions that you need to think about. Some of them being pulmonary embolism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So a blood clot in your lung. It could be a gastric ulcer. It could be pneumonia sometimes. So there are rarely people presenting with just chest pain.
So is this where you start looking at the other symptoms, like the shortness of breath and so forth? And
exactly.
Okay.
And it depends on taking a good history and examination, and it really helps you narrow down where to look.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the keys in medical practice, is really, really taking a bit of time to take a good history from someone and examining them, because you can't really test for everything.
Yes. Especially if, you know, it's this acute coronary syndrome, it's all in the short term. And if there's an ischemic event, you don't want it lasting for too long.
Exactly. And well, I guess one of the key bits in the emergency department is also to risk stratify people to make sure they're having nothing life-threatening going on.
So is that
nasty?
Now, is that, do you guys do that, or is this a triage job, or is there a number of levels of triage in which this is performed?
Yeah, yeah. So
does all chest pain go straight through, and then you guys go, okay, this you can point to where the chest pain is, so I'm not too concerned, and so forth.
Exactly. So we have skilled nurses that do triage. So they, you know, the patient comes in, they have a chat to the nurses, and the nurses assign a category anywhere from 1 to 5.
Yeah.
1 being this person's on the brink of death. Yeah. I need to see them right now. To 5, where, you know, I need my toenail clipped or something. Yeah. Right?
So, and this is a good point. Sorry to interrupt, but this is a good point, because you hear so many people, anecdotally, that will go to emergency and they said, I was sat there for 20 hours and people just went in front of me and that peed me off. And so they had something like, they might have needed stitches or something.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time they don't see people going through with the category ones, like either from the ambulance or they've gone straight through. And that a lot of people don't realise this is the way it's done.
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately the nature of the emergency department. So you'll have a lot of critically ill patients. You'll have stable patients that deteriorate and require a lot more time. Or you'll have a patient that was seemingly well and you discover something catastrophic in them. So it's very, very difficult to predict the time course and waiting times.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges we face. And, you know, we are always looking at ways to improve that, I think. But that does mean long waiting times sometimes.
Well, it's difficult because anywhere else in the world, you know, any other scenario, it's usually first in, first served. But unfortunately, when it comes to health, that's not necessarily the way it's going to be classified.
All right, so...
So just, let me just jump in for a sec. When it comes to... So you were talking about the way that an MI, which is myocardial infarction, may manifest.
Yeah.
You were saying, obviously, sort of like a squeezing, a dull, aching sort of a discomfort, elephant sitting on the chest. And you said it may be experienced in the left arm or neck or jaw or back.
It could be the right arm as well, actually.
Right arm as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes it more difficult.
So is it... Would you say it's more common to see people having these types of symptoms or experience in the left arm and neck and jaw?
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic
textbook
way of... Yeah, the textbook way of thinking. Yeah. But actually, it can present in a bunch of different ways.
Okay. So,
and sometimes people can present with a cardiac arrest after that as well.
Yeah. All right.
But I mean, if you get those textbook symptoms, then you're obviously more inclined to go the whole hog quickly.
That's fair.
Okay, so let's quickly discount, just in terms of presentation, stable angina.
Yeah.
So let's say that the person isn't presenting with a typical pain of on an exertion.
Yeah.
They've just come in with a kind of dull, aching, squeezing pain behind their sternum.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in time, am I safe by saying that you really don't know if it's going to be unstable, NSTEMI, or STEMI at this point, just by the presentation? It's too hard to predict that?
Yeah, so just at the first point of call?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you won't even know if it's an ACS.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so the first thing you potentially would do to try and find out is what?
An ECG.
ECG.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the history is really important because, you know, if this person says, I've had stents in the past, I've had a prior heart attack, I've been smoking for 200 years.
Let's assume there's been no interventions or anything like that. This is their first presentation, but they have smoked and blah, blah, blah. But you don't know which one we're talking about. So you put them on an ECG.
Yeah.
How would it be different between the three, between the unstable, NSTEMI, and STEMI? What would be the discriminating factor?
A STEMI,
or
ST elevation myocardial infarction, by definition will have elevations in the ST segments.
Okay, and
of the ECG.
How much? Is it have to be a certain size of depression, or does it have to be over more than one trace?
Yeah, so it's two or more contiguous leads.
Okay.
Over 1 millimeter.
1 millimeter. Okay.
Or if it's V2 and 3, it's more than 2 millimeters.
Okay, and so this is working off a 12-lead ECG.
That's right.
So there's many parts of the heart it's looking at.
Yeah.
And it has to go above the baseline by at least 1 millimeter. Is that right? Okay.
Unless it's V2 and 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so does that ST elevation, obviously, apart from it telling you that there's an ST elevated myocardial infarction potential at that, is it telling you about what tissue is, what part of the heart is being affected? Obviously, you've got 12 sets of eyes on the heart with these 12 leads. And you were saying, you know, if we see something in a particular lead, it has to be, you know, above this or whatever it may be. Does that tell you where it's being affected on the heart?
Exactly. So the different leads will suggest different parts of the heart. So if it's 2, 3 and AVF, for example, then it's an inferior infarct. And all the different areas of the ECG show you what different parts of the heart they are. So you can get a very good idea. And that's important because if you are seeing an inferior infarct or a right-sided infarct, then you avoid giving them nitroglycerin, for example, GTN.
Okay. So why would you do that?
Avoid? Yeah, that's because a right-sided insult is preload dependent, and if you end up dropping that by giving GTN, you'll make things significantly worse for the patient.
All right, and what about in STEMI and unstable? Yeah. What would you expect to see in the on the ECG there?
So, okay, so with the NSTEMI and unstable, you may not see anything.
Okay.
Or you may see some things like T-wave inversions or subtle changes.
Okay.
Can you get ST depressions?
You can. Yeah. You can get ST depressions.
Okay.
T-wave inversions. Or you might just see a normal ECG.
Okay. Yeah. So from out of those... Sorry, you go.
Sorry. And the way to differentiate those two is the troponin.
Right.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And that's what I was getting to. Yeah. So the first test you do, the ECG, potentially the only thing you will see different is the ST elevation with the STEMI, and then the other two may be still clumped in together. You don't know which is which.
Exactly.
All right. And so now you go to blood markers, which is enzymes that the heart muscle could release if it's damaged or dying. So what do you expect to see there? Would that, if you see an increase in markers, would that separate between STEMI and non-STEMI?
So a STEMI and non-STEMI will have an elevation in troponin.
Okay.
Yep. So they're both types of infarct.
Yeah.
So with both of them, you'll see an elevation in troponin.
Right.
And so troponin is involved in muscular contraction. And so troponin is required for the actin and myosin within these filaments to come together, form a contraction. But if it's dying off, then troponin will be released into the bloodstream. And it shouldn't be released into the bloodstream normally with a healthy musculature. What if somebody... So, obviously, you can have something called rhabdomyolysis, in which the muscle tissue is damaged due to varying reasons. Crush injuries.
Too much gym. That's what you're trying to get at.
Too much CrossFit.
It's trying to get to that point.
Well, okay, so the question I'm asking, and it may be a ridiculous question, but what if somebody came in, they've just been, they're not used to exercise, but for some reason they did their very first personal training session and the trainer
was Michael,
smashed them and they've got horrible pain. Would their troponin levels, as far as you're aware, be up and may give a false positive in this case? They may come in with chest pain because they've overexerted, and then the troponin levels, could they be up because of over exercise, or is it usually quite specific to heart damage?
Look, to be honest, from memory, I think troponin I is what's most commonly tested.
Gotcha.
Okay.
From memory, it's quite cardio-specific, but I would have to double-check.
No, that's fine.
But you can get false elevations in it. Yeah. That's not related to a myocardial infarction. So it can be caused by a bunch of different things. Even
kidney failure, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not clear in it.
Yeah. Aortic dissections.
Wow. Mm.
So a bunch of different things can cause troponin elevation as well.
Okay. And there's also creatine kinase in there as well, right? Or do you just do troponins?
It's troponin.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. And so you said that the troponin will help delineate between the non... So you said both STEMI and non-STEMI are infarcts. So tissue death, therefore release of troponin, that's going to be up.
Mm. Yeah.
So they both got it, and then the ST elevation is what delineates between non-NSTEMI and STEMI. But to delineate between the NSTEMI and the unstable angina, unstable angina is going to be this transient ischemic event, which shouldn't result in tissue death. If it does, that it's now a heart attack, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Then it's non-STEMI. Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's good.
So does that mean that angina then is just a clinical syndrome? Is there a time classification that you guys use for angina? If it lasts 20 minutes or less, it's angina, and if it goes over 20 minutes, you're having a heart attack? Or is it as soon as these markers come up and, there's leeway? Obviously, it depends on how much the vessels occluded and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, if the marker's up, then it's you're really suspicious of non-STEMI or infarct. So one of the things that actually happens is there are different guidelines for different hospitals. But what you'll do when a patient comes in is if they're at high risk, particularly if they're at high risk, you'll keep them and repeat the troponin in 6 hours.
Okay.
So when does it start to go up? So if you had someone just having a heart attack right now, this second, took their blood, chances are the troponin's not even raised yet, right?
Well, that's the thing. It can take several hours for the troponin to...
Wow.
What kind of peak are you looking at? Like 4 hours, 6 hours?
Well, we do it in 6 hours.
Okay.
Some centers do it in 3 hours. So different guidelines that they look at. So what we do in a high-risk patient is that if you're suspicious that they're still at risk for a heart attack, despite a negative troponin, normal ECG, all those things are negative, you would send them to a unit, so different hospitals have different units and different places that they do it, and you keep them for whatever the guideline of that hospital says, be it 3 hours, be it 6 hours, repeat the troponin in that time.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then...
So in the meantime, would you then, if it's unstable angina, non-STEMI, STEMI, I think you said, do you give them all aspirin? Or you don't give them all aspirin?
Yeah, so a lot of the literature says that unless there's a contraindication, just to give them aspirin, because it's generally quite harmless. The things you have to think about with giving someone aspirin is whether they had a bleeding risk. Mm-hmm. So has this person had a previous hemorrhagic stroke?
Right.
Have they had an upper GI bleed?
Yeah.
Because all of these things can be catastrophic.
Or maybe previous surgery, like recent surgery, maybe?
Yeah, sometimes. But even still, aspirin's fairly comprehensively used, actually.
And I think I read... Sorry, you go.
Sorry.
Oh, as I said, I read something just recently, and they said that out of all the drugs that are given, that aspirin seems to have the best on mortality, reduction in mortality.
It has a lot of evidence to support it, but it's still underutilized, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Clinically underutilized, yeah. That's what some of the anecdotal evidence says.
Okay. So, still,
should we say that aspirin is part of the COX pathway, blocks the COX-dependent production of the clotting cascade, and therefore you block COX, you block this clotting cascade, and you limit clotting. Mm-hmm. And so this lasts...
The stickiness of the platelets, right? So they produce thromboxin. That's at least one on top of my head. And they start to accumulate together.
Yes.
And if they do that, then I guess your chance of forming a thrombus is increased.
Yeah. And I think the platelet half-life's about 12 odd days-ish. And so that's one of the reasons why if you do take aspirin daily, that if you've got some surgery lined up, some elective surgery, they'll tell you to stop aspirin, you know, a couple of weeks before the op. Because again, like you said, you want to limit bleeding occurring.
And different types of surgeons or surgical services have different... requirements for aspirin, actually. So some will even operate with aspirin depending on the type of surgery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. So at this point in time, all three get aspirin. What's another kind of mainstay treatment? Like, what else could you use? Like nitrates? So you'll get nitrates.
So yeah, there are a whole host of interventions that can happen depending on the clinical state of the patient.
Yeah.
So you know that. Literature says uniformly you can give someone aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of support and evidence behind it, and it's unlikely to do harm unless there's a contraindication to giving it. So some of the other things that are used is morphine. Morphine is for the pain.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
is there anything in replace of morphine? Because sometimes in some of my classes, I'll say morphine, but I've got paramedics in my class. And they seem to disagree with morphine. They seem to prefer fentanyl.
Yeah. I mean, they're both opioids.
Yeah.
There's, so there's a little bit of a cost difference between them.
Okay.
But also, some literature says that unless they have severe pain to avoid morphine, because it's associated with worse outcomes.
Oh, okay.
Like myocardial infarction.
Did it also drop your blood pressure?
It can, yeah.
Okay.
One of the benefits of that is, you know, if you relieve the person's pain, their sympathetic drive drops.
Right.
Mm.
Therefore, you can reduce the myocardial demand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
So that's one of the benefits from it, and obviously the patient's pain-free, but some literature suggests that it does have poorer outcomes.
Wow. Cardiovascular outcomes or just general?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And?
So GTN, or nitrates, you avoid giving it in right-sided heart.
Okay.
Insults like we talked about. But otherwise, you can give it.
Okay.
Beta blockers, which can improve arrhythmogenic outcomes. So one of the catastrophic things that happens with myocardial infarction is that it disrupts the conduction system of the heart.
Mm.
And people can go into fatal dysrhythmias.
Right,
yeah.
And that's actually one of the, you know, one of the things that causes death.
Post-MI.
Exactly, if someone comes with the cardiac arrest.
And this is in the acute, still acute?
Mm.
Okay.
So someone might come in with a cardiac arrest or a dysrhythmia that's making them unstable hemodynamically.
Okay.
So that's one of the things that can happen.
And so when you say unstable hemodynamically, you're saying that the rhythm is in all, is occurring in such a way that it increases the likelihood of a clot forming. Because blood likes being sticky, and if it's not moving around enough or sufficiently, increases the likelihood for clots for
them? Well, that could be a consequence of it.
Okay.
But if they've had, so someone has a myocardial infarction and there's tissue death,
mm-hmm.
and if that tissue death affects their conduction system in a significant way,
yeah.
they might be coming in with different kinds of heart block, for example.
Gotcha.
Right. Okay.
Complete cardiac arrest.
VT, VF.
So, that's actually what can kill you very quickly.
So if so someone's come in, part of the tissue,
mm-hmm.
part of the myocardial tissue has died off. Let's just say it may be part of the Purkinje system or bundle branches or whatever it may be. How then do you, you know, so that when they leave the hospital, how do you then make sure that they have a normal conduction system for when they leave?
Mm.
I mean, what do you do if the tissue's gone? Is it just gone? Is there any degree of recuperation or regeneration?
So that's where the cardiologists come in the long term.
Gotcha.
And I think they can use things like pacemakers or...
Yeah, depending on the block and stuff.
Or pharmacologically control dysrhythmias as well.
Okay.
So that's a decision that they make down the track.
Cool.
So that's one. So... beta blocker. One of the really critical things in the unstable patient is actually sorting out the anatomic problem for the reason they had a heart attack.
Gotcha.
So in a big center like Gold Coast or the Royal or any of the major hospitals, they can quickly go up to the cardiac catheterization lab and get percutaneous coronary intervention.
Yeah.
So they can do angioplasty and open up the vessel, or they can stent it, or they can do a whole host of different interventions
bypass.
To restore blood flow.
Yeah.
Bypass is another one, but that's in patients who are not amenable to cardiac catheterization.
Okay.
So that's something the cardiothoracic surgeons will do, usually with a bit of planning.
Yeah.
They'll actually graft vessels into the heart to bypass the problematic area.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big operation too, isn't it?
It's not insignificant.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to open the chest right open. So you got to cut an incision straight down the sternum, retract it apart, and then stop the heart maybe, and then do some plumbing, then start the heart again, and then it's
amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fixing the anatomic abnormality, heparin or other drugs to prevent or even lies. The clocks are okay. already there.
So let me... Sorry, you go.
Yep. No,
I just wanted to say something quick with heparin there. So we've gone past just the possibility of the aggregation of the platelets into the potentially of a clot stabilizing. So that's where heparin comes in. You don't want the clot to be further cemented to make it this established clot. But if you go to STEMI, my understanding is you really block the whole vessel off with a full clot and it's fairly well much more established. And so now you want to bust it up. And that's through some of the TPAs, right? So
yeah, so lysis is only considered really in remote centres where there's no access to a catheterisation.
Right, okay.
So say you're out in, I don't know, somewhere where... You're the only doctor around, there's no catheterisation lab or anything.
Okay.
Then you'd call for some help and advice.
Yep.
And a senior person, like a cardiologist, will tell you to potentially lyse them, depending on the person's clinical state.
Okay.
So you wouldn't use it in Gold Coast?
No, they generally go up to
the lab.
Catheterization. Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Because with that, I read that TPA can only really work, or the clot busters can only work, after maybe 4-6 hours. And so if you're waiting around for, say, the results of your blood enzymes, you might have missed that window, and so the clot buster mightn't be as effective anymore.
And I'm not sure about the timelines for the clot busters, just because we just don't use them that much.
Yeah, sure enough.
If you have someone who's unstable, they'll just go up to the cath lab. Oxygen is another intervention.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, that is an interesting one because... Yeah. It used to be routinely used until some evidence came out that said that it might have some harm. But I think the general consensus at the moment is that it neither does harm or good.
Okay.
And
it's only been recent that they said it was
exactly.
harm.
Like a reperfusion oxidative injury or something.
That's the theory behind it.
Now, is it...
But
though, because I was looking into that and there seemed to be a couple of proposed... mechanisms there, and one of which was increased free radicals, oxidative species coming in, damaging the cells, already existing cells, because you're giving them 100% oxygen. Is that, as far as you're aware, is that the mechanism behind it? Obviously,
as far as I'm aware,
So will you routinely just put them on oxygen now, or is it a certain saturation?
So there are a couple of different numbers that guidelines have thrown around. Some say if they're below 93%, some say if they're below 90%.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you look at their sats and see how low
exactly,
they are.
Exactly, right. Exactly. I mean, if they're becoming hypoxic for some reason, then you'd want to give them oxygen. But if they're saturating okay, just leave it alone.
And should they be? Should they be normoxic? Should they be have normal oxygen sats?
Mm. Well, it depends.
If they're having an MI?
Yeah, it depends. Okay. If they're... significantly compromised hemodynamically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
not, I mean, a lot of variables, I guess.
Yeah. So you can, you know, there's a whole spectrum of people that you'll get. For example, you'll have someone like you or me just sitting around saying, I got a little niggle in my chest.
Mm.
Or you might get someone who's completely ashen, has fainted, you know, barely able to speak, confused. Or you might have someone in cardiac arrest.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So variable.
Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing. Thank you. This is great.
One last... Yep. I guess we should probably round up because you need to actually get to work. But let me ask you just one last question. So let's say the person has survived the MI.
Yeah.
When do they go home? Do they get admitted or they just monitored for a bit and then sent home?
So if they've had an MI, if they've had generally have a non-STEMI or a STEMI, cardiology will take them.
Yeah.
They'll maybe get catheterization.
Okay.
Or if it's more complicated, they might need a CABG or a
right.
bypass graft, which will take a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll need cardiac rehab as well.
Okay.
So that's a part of actually getting them back. In the
now,
less.
Sorry to interrupt with that. Is it now commonplace? Because I remember they used to say, you know, you've had an MI, you're bedbound now for X amount of time. Do they try and get you up as fast as possible now?
I think I'm not exactly familiar with the rehabilitation protocols of what they use. But, yeah, so...
Obviously, you don't want them going to the gym and doing a whole bunch of deadlifts, but obviously...
Yeah.
Back to his gym, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll always bring it back to him.
But I did read that you do want to give them a stress test, like a sub-maximal stress test, like so, within a week after the heart attack, right? To see...
That might be something they do. With the stress test... if you have a low-risk patient that you've not admitted to cardio or kept in the medical unit, they'll get a stress test as an inpatient or outpatient even, plus or minus a myocardial perfusion scan, which is a type of a imaging test to see if there's an ischemic event. So these might be the people that you suspect have, you know, normal troponins, normal ECG. You may have unstable angina or stable angina. And it's interesting because some of these patients have significant enough blockages to get cardiologists excited to intervene straight away.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you, your own self, anecdotally, have you seen patients, let's say they've had an event, not too severe, but they've been catheterized. Have you seen them post that you know, their pipes have been cleared out a bit? That they're just full of energy, or is it not that quick?
Well, unfortunately, we rarely get to see patients after we see them in the ED that night, you know, which is the nature of working in the ED.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so your job is sometimes, you know, often to diagnose things, get help from the different specialties, start treatment, and hand over care to them.
Yeah.
So... to be honest, I haven't actually seen anyone.
Yeah.
Because
you'd think, like, you know, if you've been occluded for, let's say, years, 70%, and then all of a sudden it's just reopened, your heart must be like, what's happening?
Yeah. I think some people do. I've heard anecdotally that they feel, you know,
it helps.
But it's a scary event for anyone.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I guess the take-home point here is anyone who's, you know, exhibiting these kind of chest pain, they should really get straight to the hospital, all right?
Exactly. Chest pain is, I mean, it can end up being a critical event. Mm. There are about, I was reading a bit of literature the other day, and it was the Heart Foundation, an Australian, and they were saying there was about around 500,000 presentations in 2012 for chest pain in Australia. Mm. Out of those, about 68,000 was actual ACS.
Okay.
So that's a bit less than 1 in 10.
Mm.
And so the rest will be presenting with some other issue, respiratory, GIT, whatever else it may be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of the American literature says about 15 to 30% of chest pains, up to 30%. I don't think it would be that much.
Mm.
Could be ACS.
Wow.
So not all chest pains are ACS, but... considering the catastrophic consequences it can have.
Worth getting checked out.
Exactly.
And for the best of the heart health, you're basically trying to get rid of the risk factors, so you'd recommend don't smoke.
Yep.
Check your diet.
Yep.
Exercise.
Yep.
Keep your blood pressure under control.
Yeah.
Any other final things?
Choose your family members a bit better.
Yeah.
History.
I mean, smoking is huge. Central obesity particularly.
Okay.
But weight in general is a big one. Exercise, obviously, and eating vegetables and having the right type of diet is very, very important. So it's really, really controllable risk factors.
Right.
Yeah.
They're the big ones.
Yeah.
All right. That was a really great episode.
That was brilliant. Thanks, Dinesh.
Oh, thanks.
We're
going
to get you on again. We need this. We need this insight. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Dr. Matt and Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. You can go on YouTube and watch some of our YouTube videos. You can go on iTunes. You can rate us. Please, if you like listening to us, give us 5 stars. If you don't like us, just don't give us... Don't even go on there. Don't comment. Don't give 1 star. 1 star is horrible. 5 stars only, everyone. apart from that, you can contact us, gubiosciences@gmail.com. And apart from that, we'll see you all soon.
All right, bye.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.